This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Andy Harrig, Vice President of Tax, Trade, Sustainability, and Policy Development for FMI, the Food Industry Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with FMI's Andy Harrig next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net. Providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland, crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The food industry and consumers have endured the ill effects of the COVID pandemic and now higher food costs as a result of inflation. Andy Harrig with FMI, the Food Industry Association, says COVID exposed known weaknesses in the food distribution system and brought about change to improve resiliency for future events.
You know, the industry, like most industries, had moved to a just-in-time model for a lot of different commodities. That makes sense for food particularly. You know, you think there's a limited shelf life for a lot of them. But for things like paper goods, like toilet paper, it doesn't necessarily have to be the case. But, you know, inventory is expensive. Carrying inventory is expensive. Storing inventory is expensive. So there is now a little bit more, and I think if you go to a supply chain conference, you'll hear the same joke that we moved from just-in-time to just-in-case on a lot of those commodities where you can build a little bit of inventories. So we've started to see that. I think we've seen better coordination on the transportation front. It's always been, I think, a very siloed area, particularly if you talk about long-haul trucking, overseas shipping, air transport. I think there's a little bit of a move towards better coordination of understanding where the infrastructure is located, where it needs to be built up, and how we move forward. So I definitely think there are lessons learned. I think we're still working out where that's going to play in the industry and the supply chain. I don't think we're ever going to build, you know, warehouses that just store toilet paper or just, you know, store coffee filters or just store baking products. But I think you're going to see larger inventories carried than you did before. You're going to see, I think, a more thoughtful ways of moving product around and making sure that we have a surge capacity for when these kind of crises hit. And I think the one thing we feel confident about, and, you know, fingers crossed it's not another pandemic. I don't think any of us want to live through that. But there are going to be crises going forward. There's going to be other big events. And with the global food supply chain, like, those events ripple outward. So, you know, it can start in Africa, it can start in Asia, it can start in Europe, and it can ripple to the United States. Conversely, it can start in the United States and ripple outward. And particularly if you think of, like, how dependent U.S. agriculture is on exports these days, you know, huge portions of it really need to export. We really need to be aware of this and think about how do we plan? How do we build that surge capacity? How do we make sure that we understand the transportation infrastructure, where it's located, how we get it where it needs to be quickly, and how we coordinate not just across companies but across national lines?
There are some places in the world, there are some cultures, and certainly even in the U.S., where people shop every day. I will tell a story on my grandfather, who would take the newspaper and look at all the grocery ads. And he would take his grocery list and get so many from one place and so many from another and so many from another, just trying to save a nickel and a dime on the way. There are also people listening to us now who haven't been inside a grocery store in some time. They're shopping online, and it's either delivered at home or they pull up to the store and it's delivered. You recently have finished the Food Retailing Industry Speaks report. What do we note about shoppers today, and how is this changing your industry?
I would say the big finding from this was really the change in the view of what constitutes value. When I started, when we talked about a value shopper, that was strictly a price-driven consumer, right? That was the mom or dad who's got 6 or 7 kids between the ages of 6 and 15 who feel like they're eating every 10 minutes and like you're worried they're actually going to like, you know, start gnawing on the wallboard if you don't keep food in the house, right? It was those people who just needed to keep the supply. What we have seen is, even though price is still really central to a lot of folks, particularly because we are in a high inflation environment, their view of value is much broader now. So it is, it has a focus on quality. It has a focus on selection. It also has a focus on things like shared values. So, you know, we see folks who are saying, you know, I really want to know that the workers who are involved in this process of producing this food, of selling us this food, that they're treated well. We want to know that the animals that are involved in animal agriculture, that they are treated well. We want to know that we're doing what we can for the environment. We want to know that this food is going to be healthy. It's going to be nourishing to us. And that often results in sort of a slightly different algorithm of what goes into these shopping decisions. You pointed to something else, too, which is the change in formats, the number of options people have, where you have, you know, big box stores, you have traditional grocery, you have specialty stores, and you also have things like convenience stores that sell food as well. So you just have a greater selection. And what we're seeing is people are really willing to travel around and choose different options. They still have a primary store that they sort of focus their efforts on, but they also then have secondary stores and tertiary stores where they will go to get specific things. And then the third one that you pointed to is the online option. One of the things that COVID did is it probably created about 10 years of growth in that area in about 10 months. You know, I think the industry was behind a lot of other retails and kind of online adoption when COVID hit. And now what you're seeing was a real transition to that by a lot of shoppers. We're off our peak levels. You know, 2021, 2022 were really the peak numbers. We saw that drop down a little bit in 2023, but those numbers are still much, much higher than pre-COVID. We're seeing a lot of shoppers who really like that. And it's a little bit counterintuitive because some of the folks who like it the best are older shoppers, boomers, Gen X, my generation, who, you know, are sometimes seen as sort of not good at technology or resistant to it. And some of those younger shoppers very much like shopping in the store. They like going in and kind of, you know, squeezing the avocado and making sure it's fresh and kind of seeing that kind of visceral experience of it. So it's a little bit, you know, while the age cohorts are really useful, to understand other aspects of shopping, when it comes to online adoption, it's a little bit counterintuitive and it's a little bit all over the place. So it's really interesting. And I think the next 5 years are going to really, continue to see a really rapid change in that particular segment.
Some might have suggested with the growth of online shopping that we'll end up not having supermarkets anymore. It'll just be a destination that you'll pull up to and that'll be it. We won't shop in the store anymore. But as you suggest, these younger generations seem to be much more interested in the food that they buy and in the food that they take home.
It's a big change. People are coming into the marketplace. As they age into it, you know, they get out of high school, they go to college, or they go into the workforce and they start getting their own places. They start engaging in this and they're coming in with different expectations and a different kinds of engagement. What we see is those younger generation, millennials and then Gen Z, for instance, they are much more engaged on sustainability issues. Close to half of those shoppers say, I frequent and I prioritize stores that prioritize sustainability. Those numbers are much lower on something like sustainability for older shoppers. But they're coming in, you know, they're different. They've been raised with this idea of the environment and how to engage with it and the impacts of climate change. And so this is baked into their DNA when they enter the marketplace. And so it's really, it's different. And we're adapting to them and you see this. But they are definitely very engaged in the brick and mortar experience. And when you look at the online kind of marketplace, what we call the last mile, you know, how we get it to the consumer's home. That is still really challenging, you know, and one of the things that people have really liked is the click and collect. You order online, then you go to a grocery store and pick it up. People still like that. It's, I think a lot of, retailers feel like that's a fairly efficient way to sort of have brought their online offerings to the consumers. And, you know, it very much enhances that brick and mortar experience. And so I don't think we're going to see the stores go anywhere anytime soon. I think the upside of this, though, is because you do have the option of delivery, particularly if you are in areas where there's less service, maybe in inner city communities, maybe in very urban areas, you know, to have that option for delivery and to give you a little bit more of choice in that process, I think is important. So I think It's going to be exciting to see going forward.
Whether it's the product on the shelf that is already prepared that just might be heat and eat, or preparation made in advance so cooking is expedited at home, or whether it's the salad bar or the cafeteria style buffet where people can come in and not just shop for products for their pantry, but also take a meal home. Is this changing? Are we seeing attitudes that are changing the in-store experience?
It is, and I think part of it is the result of COVID, where people could not go to restaurants, and they still wanted a restaurant-like experience. They didn't want to have to do all the cooking. So you saw a real emergence of meal kits at the stores. You saw heat and eat options expand. Even as, you know, maybe some of those food bars were closed due to COVID regulations, packaged versions of those foods were available. So people really value convenience. And I was actually just looking at some of our data that came out, and one of the things we've seen is people's willingness and the time they spend cooking has steadily decreased. So right now, the majority of people say they spend an hour or less preparing meals. Before, that number was much higher. It was over 75% spent more than an hour when they cooked. So this idea of convenience, of how we meet people where they live, people are working again. You know, a lot of them are going back to the office at least a couple days a week. Their kids are back playing sports. That issue of convenience and how you really reflect their lifestyle. But what we also need to do, though, is adapt to the other things that they are looking for. So, for instance, there's a big emphasis these days on health and wellness. So can we meet the consumer where they're living and give them healthier options and help them understand as they're putting a meal together the kind of, you know, what it means for their family's nutrition. And so you see a lot more information available. You see a lot more kind of, you know, pick one from column A, pick a side dish from column C, and this to try to help create this healthy balance and these opportunities. So it's really exciting. I think you're seeing a lot of innovation here. You know, I think if you think of the hot bars and stuff as just kind of rotisserie chickens, but I'm just saying it has expanded much beyond the kind of pre-COVID offerings where your opportunities now to create a convenient meal, some of which you may prepare yourself, some of which may be pre-prepared, some of which may be frozen, some of which may be canned. Those opportunities, and I think the materials we're bringing to help people understand how to seize those opportunities are really different. And you also actually see a lot of restaurants who are adapting in that way too. So I think some of the old breakdown between food at home and food away from home, and this is me, this is not necessarily an FMI position, but I think some of those meetings are just a little bit less meaningful than they were.
So you used a word earlier, sustainability. So from the function of the companies that you represent, or moreover, for the attitude of the shopper, how is sustainability coming into your industry, both from how you do business and also how consumers are shopping today? How big is that word? Is that a capital S or is it lowercase?
Yeah, I would say in terms of it's important, it's a capital S. In terms of the economics of it, it's probably a lowercase S. So what I mean by that is I think when you look at the operational side of this, our members are really looking at, and COVID, I think, helped jumpstart this process, is how do we create supply chains? How do we create operations that are quote-unquote sustainable? And what that means is how can we make sure that they are operating 5 years and 50 years, theoretically in 500 years, in a way that continues to reflect consumer needs, that is regenerative, that does not extract resources or drain those resources down, but either is sort of neutral or regenerative. And so people are really thinking about it in those terms. And that can take a lot of different forms. One of the things we talk to our companies about is when they're figuring out what their sustainability policy should be is to really understand their consumer base, but also understand their employee base. What do their associates want? And make sure that those policies you adopt reflect the culture of the company and where you want to head. With consumers, one of the real frustrations is when you poll them, they say, yeah, I really want the stores I shop at to be sustainable. Particularly younger shoppers say, I'd like to see that we share the same values. They don't have to be exactly the same, but we want to see that you know, there's kind of this, things that are important to me are also important to this company.
Andy, I'm asking for your perspective here, whether it is the commodity organization, whether it is an individual farmer, whether it is a food company. Where do consumers like to be met, and how are they influenced in buying decisions? There was a time that we spent a lot of time in the grocery store, meeting shoppers where they are, farmer to consumer, and making a point. Where is that meeting place today where information that is sought after can be delivered with the most impact?
Yeah, I would say that every part of the supply chain needs to be engaged in that. If you look at surveys on public trust, what we've seen is a real erosion of people's trust in institutions. So federal government, state governments, corporations, lots of that has decreased significantly, lots of those trust levels. But in our surveys anyways, people still really, when it comes to their health, when it comes to value, they have a tremendous amount of trust in farmers and ranchers. Just slightly behind that is they have a lot of trust in their local store. And so those are opportunities there. But I think every part of the supply chain now really needs to think of itself as consumer-facing. And part of my work is to go out and talk to different groups and say, share our data and tell them what consumers are telling us, but also to encourage them, you know, to no longer think of yourself as three steps back in the supply chain and consumers aren't going to know who you are. Because part of what they're asking us is, we want transparency in the food supply chain. We want to know where our food comes from. 10, 15 years ago, that was probably one step back or two steps back. Now, if you map that out, that's going to look more like a splatter chart. They want to sometimes know what their supplier looks like. They want to know the people who create the feed components, how that plays into the supply chain. So, you know, people don't want to have to feel like they have to have a PhD in agronomy, or that they have to be an animal behavior specialist, but they want you to sort of give them this information in a way that's thoughtful, that they can engage with, and where they feel like, yeah, I can trust them. They've shown me that they're working on this.
Andy, there is a consumer today where their food is not as big of a percentage of their overall income as there is for others. We talked recently about the consumer price index and how it has changed. For those who are spending more of their disposable income to care for their families, how have they endured this economic time with regard to shopping and the food that they take home?
We've seen lots of adaptations. We have a list of about 17 different practices that people have engaged in, and we measure the percentage of shoppers who do this. So, I mean, obviously the one is they shop around a little bit more. I'm talking to you on an iPhone right now. That has been an incredible tool for price comparisons that people can do. You have a lot more visibility on costs associated with food thanks to that. We've seen that a lot of shoppers are incredibly savvy, and they will look at shelf tags, they'll look at unit pricing, and they really understand what those changes in prices mean. Some people have turned to store brands, and that's private label products. You know, when I was a kid, that used to be often sometimes termed generic food and other stuff, but if you look over the last 20 years, those private label products, the quality of them has grown so much that now that they are a serious competitor in the food marketplace. So a lot of folks have turned to that. Some folks have changed, made some swaps in what they buy. You know, the one we always offer is, you know, some folks maybe moved from chicken breast to chicken thighs. Maybe instead of getting steak once a month, they're doing twice a month for ground beef. Maybe they're buying beer a little bit less than they used to before, or they're having a bottle of wine with dinner, only on Saturdays and not Friday and Saturday. So some of those folks are making that. But if you actually look at the spend levels, they've stayed pretty consistent over the past 2 years. They're about $164. Last time we polled in February, it was $165. In December of 2023, it was $164. So we've seen real consistency, and that was pretty much on par for all of 2023. So that's a little bit of a good news, bad news situation. Obviously, the bad news is those numbers are up from pre-COVID, and that's not great. That means people are paying more. But the good news is people do have that money. They are able to do this. If you go back to, for instance, the 2008-2009 recession, we saw that weekly spend just fall off a cliff. it really dropped fairly significantly, because people just didn't have the money. You know, unemployment was over 10%. People were going on to SNAP. They were going, to food banks. They just didn't have that. And the good news is that, at least as we've seen up to this point, folks have really continued to have that money. So even as they're making some of the substitutions and some of the adaptions to how they eat, they've still been able to, I think, get not just what they need, but in lots of cases, still be able to get a lot of what they want.
Andy, we'll finish with this. There appears to be perhaps a stalemate in Washington with regard to farm and food policy. But from the FMI perspective, is there an element of this farm bill or elements that are important to you to see in new legislation that, assuming it's done, would cover the next 5 years?
I mean, our focus is often on the SNAP portion of this, the sort of nutrition portion of the farm and nutrition. That's important to us. But it's really important that the sort of traditional coalition of farm and nutrition advocates, that they really stay together on this. This bill doesn't move as two separate packages, even though, again, SNAP and some of those feeding issues, for obvious reasons, since people spend those SNAP dollars in our stores, that's sort of top of mind for us. Building a safe agricultural industry where there's a good safety net in place is just as important to us. There's a kind of a symbiosis and a kind of a need between agriculture and retail in this country. We cannot import our way to anything like the food system we have at the retail level. We need strong farms in the United States. We need to have a good farm safety net where we continue to see, you know, opportunities for new entrants, making sure that existing entrants are able to create profitable businesses. Conversely, agriculture cannot export its way to where it needs to be. It needs retail. So there is real U.S. retail. So there really is, I think we are hand in hand here in what's important to us. So what's important to the farm community is important to retail. And I think in the large case, in most cases, people would say vice versa as well. So we just would love to see progress on this. We think there's opportunity. You know, legislation is always messy. There's always that joke about you never want to see how the sausage is made. This will be no exception. But I think at the end of the day, whether you're in a farm community, or whether you're in a city and you're never seen a farm and you don't know where your food comes from, but you shop at a grocery store, you have an interest in making sure there is a good, strong farm bill out there. And I am confident that at the end of the day, that will get done. I'm not going to make a prediction when, but we...
Well, Andy Harrick, we want to thank you very much for taking time to share the FMI perspective with us here on Open Mic. Andy, it is Open Mic. I've asked all the questions. You have an open platform for your message today, sir.
No, I mean, I think what I would just continue to reemphasize is that it is really important that the food supply chain really engages with the American consumer to help them understand where food comes from. We sometimes, we have a kind of a little bit of a joke here that when you talk to a lot of folks, because, you know, people have moved away from rural communities. You know, I saw something, you know, 60 years ago that 40% of people lived in farm communities, or 50% of people. Now it's much, much smaller. The number of people who've been on a farm, who have families that farm, those are way down. A lot of folks tend to view agriculture from a place where they don't know a lot about what it looks like. And we kind of joke that a lot of them think it looks like Charlotte's Web, right? Like, and really, it's, you know, it is a much more complex view that needs to be communicated. And it's really important that we do that, because if we're not out there spreading that message, other people are going to step into that vacuum and they're going to spread messages that are not true. And we've seen that over and over again over the past decade. So it is really important that we do this. There's tensions between different parts of the supply chain. There's no denying that. We need to continue to work on that, but we also need to, I think, be really super aware that we need, as a supply chain, as in an industry, food and agriculture writ large, we need to be out there and really helping consumers understand where their food's coming from. The 10,000 things that go right to get something to a grocery store shelf. Because, like I said, we're just concerned. I mean, with the internet, it is so easy to find bad information and stumble upon it. So we need to be sure that we're out there and we're driving good information to people. And that, to me, is the most important thing. It's not the 1950s. It's not the 1960s anymore. where we can look at this as a little bit more siloed, and each segment of the industry is kind of on its own, doing its own thing. We all have an interest in this.
Our thanks to Andy Harrig with FMI, the Food Industry Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.